Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And we really appreciate you taking time today for another edition of Midrats. A quick note to those that are with us live. If you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. That's a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. And if you have some observations about the show you'd like to share, or if there is a question that you would like for us to address to our guests, it doesn't look like we're heading in that particular area, please put that in the chat room. Eagle One and myself will both be monitoring that during the course of the program, and we'd love to steal your ideas and claim them as our own. And if you got to run off halfway through the show and you want to see what you missed, or if we get near the end of the hour and we're talking and all of a sudden the line goes dead, not on your end, the live show does terminate right at the 60-minute mark, but it keeps recording afterwards in case there's one more question that we want to squeak out or we want to give our guests time to fully flesh out their answers. So there might be a few minutes of after show. You can catch that and all of our previous episodes over at the show page at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take a shortcut and subscribe to the free podcast at iTunes or Stitcher. And up to that, though, let's go ahead and plow into the topic of today. We're returning back to Westpac on something that those have been reading about it have started to see more and more mentions of, and that's China's use of a variety of tools non-traditional to what, from the American mind, we think of, that if we want to do something fancy, we throw a White Hulk Coast Guard cutter out there as opposed to a Gray Hulk Navy ship, is that China tries to claim portions of her near abroad in the South China Sea and elsewhere. Part of their effort includes what most can consider as a good description of this type of irregular naval force as their maritime militia. What we want to do today is we're going to look at what China is doing with their maritime militia, why they're using this tool, and what could we expect going forward as this starts to influence and create certain, lack of a better phrase, set of facts at the ground, facts at sea in China's near and broad. And our guest for the full hour to discuss this and related issues will be Dr. Andrew S. Erickson. Dr. Erickson is a professor of strategy at the U.S. Naval War College's China Maritime Studies Institute. Since 2008, he's also been an associate in research at Harvard University's John King Fairbanks Center for Chinese Studies. He is an expert and contributor to the Wall Street Journal China Real-Time Report, for which he has authored and co-authored 37 different articles. He received his Ph.D. and M.A. in International Relations and Comparative Politics from Princeton University, and graduated magna cum laude from Amherst College with a B.A. in History and Political Science. He has studied Mandarin at both Princeton and Beijing program, the Princeton-Beijing program at Beijing Normal University's College of Chinese Language and Culture. He's also studied the Japanese language, politics, and economics in a year-long Associated Kyoto program at Doshisha University. Andrew has also worked at SAIC, which many of you all should be familiar with, as a Chinese translator and a technical analyst. He also gained early experience working at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, consulate in Hong Kong, as well up on the Hill and the White House. He is proficient in Mandarin and Chinese, which we are not, so that won't be coming up today, and Japanese, and he's traveled extensively in Asia, living in China, Korea, and, of course, Japan. Andrew, welcome to Midrats.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure, and I appreciate the kind introduction.
And we really appreciate you taking time this Sunday afternoon to share an hour with us. And I thought I'd give you an opportunity as a scene setter to describe for the listener when you're writing about the Chinese maritime militia, when did this start to come into the lexicon, and what asset is China using, and where can people expect that this be creating effects at sea in the South China Sea and elsewhere?
Well, thank you very much. Those are all important questions that I've been dealing with quite a lot in my intellectual life over the past 2 years. So for some time, I was aware from a variety, so for a number of years now, I've been aware from a variety of Chinese language sources that China's fishing fleet, the world's largest, was seen as a source not only of economic activity for China, but also of some strategic, operational, and tactical potential. And as with so many things in Chinese language open source research, the more you look regarding a specific topic, the more you find that there's actually a surprising amount of information out there. As I always like to say, China is often more transparent than we think, at least in Chinese language sources. Now, I started investigating that in early 2014, and I was soon joined by my colleague at the Naval War College who joined us, Connor Kennedy, and he's been doing this in-depth research with me. And what we quickly found was that whereas what I say about China being understandable from open sources in the Chinese language is often true in general, it is true to an unusual degree on this topic of China's maritime militia, hitherto all too understudied, all too obscure. We're now at the point where we have many Chinese language open sources to analyze on this topic. In fact, it's like drinking and translating from a fire hose. It's a good problem to have, but it's a deluge of information. But I think already in our research, we have a basic understanding of what the militia is, maritime militia is, what China's trying to use it for. And the timing of your show, frankly, couldn't be better, because on this coming Tuesday, July 12th, the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague is set to issue a ruling regarding a case that was brought up by the Philippines to address some international maritime legal issues concerning the South China Sea. Now, I certainly don't know exactly how they're going to rule. No doubt China has tried to find out through a variety of means, but my strong suspicion is that this Permanent Court of Arbitration is going to question or reject at least some of the key bases for Beijing's sweeping but somewhat nebulous territorial claims in the South China Sea, in particular China's very non-legal approach of arguing that some kind of pattern of historic rights should give it the right to these sweeping claims that really cover almost this whole enormous body of water through that nine dashed line you may have seen on a variety of maps. So the reason I think that China's maritime militia is a particularly timely topic here is that China clearly opposes the very existence of this international legal case. Its government is bitterly opposed to it, and I think feels in a very uncomfortable position. So I think in the days and months following this case, we're going to see a variety of Chinese actions designed to show that China can't be hemmed in by any sort of international court's ruling, And one of these types of actions, I believe, could be using some of the elite maritime militia forces to perhaps intensify the heat of some sort of U.S. freedom of navigation operation in the South China Sea, potentially also some sort of actions to harass other nations' maritime forces in the South China Sea, whether they're from Vietnam or perhaps the Philippines. This would be China's way of sort of kicking under the table and saying, look, we're the most powerful claimant in the South China Sea, and no smaller neighbor should try to get in the way of our claim. So I'm concerned that China could try to use this force in this regard, and I'm concerned that they might be particularly emboldened to do so, because so far it doesn't seem like there's a lot of public understanding of this maritime militia. For example, to the very best of my knowledge, no public U.S. government report and no public statement by any Washington-based U.S. official has actually mentioned the maritime militia. I can tell you from some of my conversations with maritime experts from other South China Sea countries, there's a lot of confusion as to why the U.S. hasn't mentioned this in some sort of unambiguous central official capacity. So I think it's a perfect time to discuss this on your show and with your listeners, who I know are right at the front lines of maritime security and naval analysis. So I'm really excited that we can be having this conversation here.
Well, let's back up a little bit. I think in one of your articles that I read, you talk about the fact that China has three elements in their essentially their naval forces. They have the planned Navy, which is the gray hulls, sort of like our U.S. Navy. And then they have a Chinese Coast Guard, which is large and has very modern ships in it, which and covers a lot of ground. And then they have the naval militia. Could you kind of describe what exactly makes up the maritime militia? Is the Chinese maritime militia unique? And how so far? I know they used them, or we've seen what we think were use of there in a couple of other incidences, like the USS Impeccable Adventure. Could you kind of discuss those points?
Oh yes, absolutely. So while China is still partially a land power, it's definitely already partially a sea power as well, and it's a major sea power. And there's a government effort to really transform it into a great maritime power by all measures. So, as you mentioned, China has a navy that is, in fact, the world's largest blue water navy, even though it's still focused more on China's unresolved island feature and maritime claims closer to home. Then there's China's Coast Guard. There are some teething issues as the different forces that civil maritime forces of China are being consolidated into one single Coast Guard. But in aggregate, this is the world's largest blue water Coast Guard, and they're receiving a lot, many new hulls. Regionally, there is just no comparison except for Japan's very capable Coast Guard, but Japan's Coast Guard can't compete in terms of numbers looking forward. Now that brings us to the maritime militia. It is not as nearly as large or as capable, but I truly believe that it merits designation as China's third sea force because it has long supported the other two sea forces, including in some frontline international sea incidents, skirmishes, and at least one battle. So here are five top incidents that China's maritime militia has played, it can unambiguously be documented, and we've documented it, to play a key role in. The 1974 seizure of the western portion of the Paracel Islands from Vietnam in the Battle of the Paracels, not just a cameo role, but a substantive role. The 2009 harassment of the U.S. survey ship Impeccable. In many ways, I think that incident needs to be studied as we consider what challenges China might seek to pose for future U.S. freedom of navigation operations in the region. Then the 2011 sabotage on two different occasions of two separate Vietnamese hydrographic vessels. The 2012 seizure of Scarborough Shoal from the Philippines, and the 2014 repulsion of Vietnamese vessels from disputed waters surrounding China's HYSY-981 oil rig. Now, in the 2009 Impeccable incident and the 2014 oil rig incident, we can see quite clearly that Chinese maritime militia vessels were coordinating quite closely in their operations with Chinese Coast Guard vessels and Chinese naval vessels. So China's most elite, China's leading maritime militia forces are entrusted with coordinating closely with the other two sea forces in some important international sea incidents that China tries to use to uphold and advance its disputed claims. And, of course, these aren't things that can just be done at the drop of a hat when it's required by policymakers. These have to be trained for. And we see more and more exercises where leading Chinese maritime militia units are receiving training directly from naval units and participating in exercises with Chinese Navy and Chinese Coast Guard units. Now, many people are confused as to what exactly this maritime militia is. Sure, we can see the vessels engaged in some of these operations, but who's actually directing them? How do they fit into the larger picture? Well, fortunately, authoritative Chinese language sources also document this quite clearly. Advanced maritime militia. So think of the maritime militia as a huge pyramid of forces. There are thousands of Chinese maritime militia personnel and vessels directly enrolled in China's maritime militia. The vast majority of these personnel and vessels are engaged in relatively mundane tasks very close to China's undisputed coastline. It is a small elite among these forces that are trained for and entrusted with these frontline international sea incident missions. And Connor Kennedy and I are covering these in our ongoing series through the Center for International Maritime Security on the leading maritime militia of Hainan Province. No, fortunately, it's not a reality TV show. This is rather the collection of maritime militia units that we tend to see on the front lines time and time again. And when we do see them on the front lines, for example, participating and supporting directly those incidents that I described, incidents like that, they are doing so specifically on behalf of the Chinese state, receiving orders and reporting directly back up to a People's Liberation Army, so a Chinese military chain of command. There's a linkage to this chain of command through local PLA organizations called People's Armed Forces Departments. Staffed at their upper levels with active duty PLA personnel, these PAFDs are the direct managers of China's advanced maritime militia units for recruitment, planning, organization, training, and policy execution. So there's no question that for the incidents that are of concern to the U.S. and to China's direct neighbors in the South China Sea, we can see a direct linkage to a PLA chain of command and to a Chinese state direction in terms of what these maritime militia are supposed to do. Now, let's go back to the Impeccable incident, the March 2009 Impeccable incident, for a minute, because this gives us a very direct example of this. So in that incident, as you and many of your listeners may know, the USNS Impeccable on March 8th was surrounded by a group of five Chinese ships in international waters 75 miles south of Hainan Province in the South China Sea. And two of the five vessels, which included Chinese Navy and Coast Guard ships, two trawlers closed in to attempt to disrupt the survey ship's operations and drive it away. You've probably seen the famous video clip and image of a trawler coming up close to Impeccable and with a person on the deck with a very long grappling hook attempting to snag the towed array. Well, that's not just some random fishing trawler. That's not just some random patriotic fisherman who stumbled upon Impeccable's operations. Rather, you can look at that image as we've done. You can run the VIN number, so to speak, on the hull number of the ship. Well, if you just look at that hull number, there are three Chinese characters, Qiong San Ya, and then the numbers 8399. Well, Qiong is the abbreviation for Hainan Province for shipping, and then San Ya says it's from San Ya City on the south of Hainan Island. And then when you run that 8399 VIN number, you find that, trawler F8399 belonged at the time to the Sanya Fugong Fisheries Company Limited, which is connected to China's military directly as a maritime militia organization. Not just that, you start looking through Chinese sources on this basis, and you can see that the ship is owned by someone named Lin Wei, who was piloting that trawler at the time of the Impeccable incident. He is specifically a cadre in the maritime militia organization called the Sanya Fugong Fisheries Company. Not just that, he's gone on to bigger and better things in terms of shipping. Now he owns at least one 3,000-ton command and supply vessel that is now allowing maritime militia vessels from Sanya City to go down to fish more persistently in the Spratlys and to be available for operations there. So that's just one example of where this is no mystery. We can find authoritative Chinese sources saying how the China's maritime militia reports to and takes orders from a military chain of command, and we can trace this down through a specific example. And frankly, it's pretty interesting to just see how far into detail we can go on that.
Andrew, I wanted to tap into something that you have that very few people have, and that's not just your fluency in Mandarin, but the fact you've actually lived in China and you interact with Chinese nationals on a regular basis. And I think part of the challenge that we have in trying to understand why China makes the steps that they do is very similar to why we have a hard time understanding why Russia does what it does. And I think the challenge with Russians is a little more difficult because they seem European, but they're not. Russians are Russians, but the Chinese are definitely Chinese. They have a different history, a different cultural context at which they look at things. And I wonder if you take a moment and discuss what type of blinders we may not even know that we have in trying to understand the Chinese and why they're doing what they're doing with their three navies in the South China Sea, their very flinty nature against these little shoals, because it's more than just economics and energy going on here. You know, we look at things in America and the West from a very legalistic mindset, referencing everything to our own historical experience and our own historical bold-faced items, so to speak, as opposed to what other nations and distinct cultures like the Chinese may have. Is that cultural understanding disconnect? Is that a significant part of this? And what is something that a lot of people are missing about why the Chinese are very driven to this beyond economics and just square footage?
Absolutely. Well, there are definitely some things that are different about China in terms of official policies and how that plays out in society. And I think we can probably have an almost endless debate about to what extent this is deeply historical and cultural versus to what extent this has to do with the political system in the People's Republic of China right now, and how that has implications for how society is set up, and how both leaders and citizens are incentivized to act and to portray their actions. So rather than trying to split it down exactly, and we, you know, there are ways to try to tease that out. You can compare mainland China and Taiwan and overseas Chinese communities, but I think the key points are these in terms of how China is certainly different from the U.S. and really much of the West for all practical intents and purposes, and to the extent this is different from Russia or similar, you'll have to get a Russia expert on your program, because that is beyond my area of expertise. But I would say a couple things. First of all, I think even if the Chinese Communist Party were not running the show and shaping Chinese society right now, there's no question that from around 1840 to 1945, China did go through a very bitter century of humiliation and division and chaos. And these aren't just issues, as my colleague, the director of our China Maritime Studies Institute, Peter Dutton, says. They're not just issues of history textbooks. These are issues of the family scrapbook and many families' discussions, bitter memories of the World War II era, for instance. So I think, however Chinese society would be run today, there is certainly an amount of a nationalism and a desire to have a strong China that can't be carved up and humiliated. Nevertheless, I think it's also beyond question, in my personal view, that China's Communist Party has seized on this history, and in many ways would be seen by many historians to have distorted it and manipulated it, especially as the Chinese Communist Party seeks sources of legitimacy beyond the rapid economic growth of the last three decades that now really seems to be ebbing to quite a degree. So before, it was really economics and nationalism, the two legs of Chinese Communist Party legitimacy, the things that the party could always turn to when facing Chinese society and say, look, whatever you think of some of the specific things we've done, such as the Tiananmen massacre, we have delivered things that no Chinese government could deliver before before. We have conclusively ended the cycle of humiliation. We've brought China into the modern world in a position of pride and progress while defending a and promoting a unique Chinese identity. So now, as the party is potentially entering into an era of having to rely more on the nationalism card without as much economic progress to help its legitimacy, it seems to be doubling down on its argument that China has a set of historic claims that are inherently legitimate. Most of those unresolved claims are in what Chinese strategists would call the Near Seas, the Yellow Sea, the East China Sea, and the South China Sea. Obviously, the biggest one of those claims is Taiwan, but there are quite a few island feature, other types of feature, and maritime zone claims in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. So the party is positioning itself as the standard bearer for China's interests, and also as the one force that has the capability of upholding and safeguarding and furthering those interests. So I think we should not underestimate just how strong these forces are in Chinese society. And they're partly strong because, as Peter Dutton says, China's government, the Communist Party, has worked to through so-called patriotic education and shaping history, many would say distorting history, creating a demand that only they can supply, a demand signal that only they can answer. Certainly China's Communist Party has worked to enhance and whip up nationalism. But as I said before, there would be a certain amount of nationalism no matter what. What this all means is probably any government of China right now would feel that it had to do at least a certain degree of things to uphold and further some of these claims. And China's maritime militia is seen as a good tool in that toolbox because the thought is, at least up until now, these forces could try to push and pressure and coerce and nibble away at the edges to advance China's claims while not attracting that much attention and certainly not allowing things to escalate to the point of an actual armed conflict. So this is how I would say the maritime militia fit into what is a very important larger geopolitical and geostrategic picture. But I want to add two other things that I think as outside observers, particularly coming from the West and especially in the U.S., it helps to remind ourselves of. First of all, I think outsiders may spend time seeing contradictions in Chinese government or statements by Chinese citizens and may spend too much time being surprised by that. For example, Al Jazeera recently sent a media team down to Tianmen in on the southeast coast of Hainan Island, the site of one of the other leading maritime militias, which Paramount leader Xi Jinping himself visited in 2013, and this has been designated a national model maritime militia. So Al Jazeera went down there at the beginning of June, and they saw 40 to 50 fatigue-clad militiamen drilling. There were some very disingenuous explanations offered by Chinese officials. A local propaganda official tried to palm these militiamen off as part of a film crew, which sounds pretty silly. But then, to add insult to injury on this, then the foreign reporters happened to run into someone named Wang Shumao, who is the deputy commander of the Tianmen militia, it turns out. Not only that, he led Tonmen militia forces into frontline participation in the Scarborough Shoal standoff with the Philippines in 2012, and also the oil rig incident with Vietnam in 2014. Yet he reportedly directly told the Al Jazeera reporters that he denied knowing anything about the militia. Well, we shouldn't be surprised by that sort of thing, because the fact is, someone in his position in what is in many ways still a very harsh authoritarian Leninist system is going to say whatever he has to say in order to not make a mistake in front of foreigners that could get him in trouble. So I don't know the exact circumstances that those reporters were in. I wish they had perhaps had a few more details in their hip pocket so they could have pressed him further. Finally, one other point to get back to your question about how might outside Western observers tend to think differently. At least in Western media, to include, say, New York Times articles, that kind of reporting, I see what I feel is a tone frequently of, China is doing a lot of things that are very harsh and very counterproductive, and this will be self-defeating. In fact, in certain Washington policy circles or policy relevant circles, I even hear a phrase akin to self-containing behavior. The implication seems to be, in some cases, that, well, if we just wait long enough, China will either see the error of their ways, or they'll just somehow automatically be contained by their bad behavior, and then we won't have to worry about it. And I think it's really not that simple. Tom Christensen, one of the leading China scholars of this era, and in full disclosure, my mentor, has rightly called China's current leadership the High Church of Realpolitik. And I think this designation is quite relevant, because it suggests that they are acutely attuned to perceived relative differences in power. Maybe overtuned, maybe sometimes they have a misfire and they overextrapolate. But the point is, if China's leadership feels that it's making progress in the South China Sea and there are prices that are worth paying, they may be willing to pay those prices. Clearly, in the last few years, we've seen a great falling in China's popularity and approval in the region. We see grave concerns on the part of many other regional countries and many of their policymakers. But yet, the assumption of Xi Jinping and the current Chinese leadership appears to be for certain priorities, such as looking strong in front of the Chinese people regarding these outstanding territorial claims that the Chinese Communist Party for years has been telling the Chinese people belong to China, those prices may be seen as worth paying. So if we want China to have different behavior when it comes to these areas that matter a lot to China's current leadership, there's almost no set of phrases that we can just say to express our opposition that will automatically make China's leadership feel they've seen the error of their ways. We actually have to find ways to impose costs if it's a high enough priority for us. But one piece of good news in all that, because imposing costs is something you have to think carefully about doing, I think in the case of the maritime militia, this is such an unusual force. It has some real strengths, but it has some real weaknesses. And one of the weaknesses is that for it to be a maritime militia, for it to have the role and the nature that it does, it's always going to be inherently limited in certain areas of sophistication, capabilities, and protection. And I believe if the U.S. government can finally, for lack of a better term, call out publicly this maritime militia, if we can raise awareness about it and demonstrate some determination to not be stopped by it, to not accept harassment, and to say, look, we know these are not just random fishermen, and we will not allow them to interfere with the safety of our vessels or freedom of navigation or mission accomplishment. I think that's a space where there's some productive room for us to make progress in, and the more light we shine on this maritime militia, I think the more we can undermine its ability to lurk in the shadows and do its worst, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by the sort of disinformation campaign the Chinese have mounted on this. We got classic asymmetrical warfare here, and Sun Tzu would be so proud of them. They've come with this organization that they can plausibly deny that it's really military. When Florence Liu, or whatever her name is, who went for Al Jazeera, went and saw these guys, it's almost laughable that they denied the existence of a maritime militia. And, you know, the Star Wars quote, "These are not the droids you're looking for,"
yes,
kind of came to my mind as I was reading that. But it's I was talking to my wife about this. I said, you know, if they pretend that they're nothing but harmless civilian fishermen and they provoke an incident, and for some either U.S. or some other force takes out some of these guys, they're gonna play that innocent civilian card very, very, very strongly and loudly. Is that exactly what you're seeing with this, or is there even more finesse to this than I can pick up on?
Well, you're raising exactly some of the concerns that I have. And fortunately, as I've already alluded to, I do think that there is good progress that we can make in mitigating this risk. Obviously, as with everything I'm saying here, these are solely my personal views, and I can't speak for any aspect of U.S. government policy or estimates. But I'm optimistic that over time, my views will gain currency in actual U.S. government policymaking. I just am urging that be as soon as possible, because particularly with this July 12th Permanent Court of Arbitration ruling on Tuesday, I think China will be very upset and try to find some ways to push back over time. And I think you're spot on when you allude to the possibility that China might try to arrange the optics to make things very difficult for the U.S. If there's some kind of encounter, whether planned by China or actually not really an accident that's not intended by either side. I think China's been developing a maritime militia at least since the early 1950s. Now it's gone through many iterations, but guerrilla warfare is Chinese Communist Party guerrilla warfare is really as old as the Chinese Communist Party and its party army, the PLA, it dates from the very beginning. So there's long been a lot of thinking on this, a lot of action on this. Their system understands this very well and is wielding this, as I say, as one of the three sea forces. And the U.S. has a lot of work to do to properly wrap its head around this and prepare in real time, ahead of time, so it doesn't have to be dealing with this in real time, including in the information space. When China's very large and able propaganda apparatus could use any combination of selective photographs, videos, stories, I mean, who's to say that already China isn't collecting various types of images from, for example, freedom of navigation operations that it could then splice in a very misleading way into some kind of narrative that goes up on television in the unfortunate event of some sort of incident. The U.S., long before this ever becomes a CNN-type issue, I think the U.S. government needs to get out on record in some sort of authoritative form and describe that it knows very clearly what China's maritime militia is, along the lines that I've described, that it is, that it answers to a PLA chain of command, that it is charged specifically with frontline participation in Chinese state actions. I have, in fact, distilled this to three principles. One, China's maritime militia force is a military force, often in disguise. Two, China's maritime militia forces do not deserve civilian protections in the event of conflict. These are not mere civilians who are acting in this capacity, and they should not be treated as such legally when they are clearly engaged in operations that require answering to a PLA chain of command and serving China's state policy. And third, as I said before, I believe that uncovering the truth about China's maritime militia is the best way to deter it. These forces have considerable weaknesses. Some of them are veterans. Some of the leading militia men, and now there are also some leading militia women as well, they are veterans of some significant events, but they have not been fully tested in terms of what types of situations they might face. They have virtually no protections were things to make them vulnerable in some sort of an encounter. In short, I think if maritime militia forces were to understand how serious the U.S. could be about this situation and how precarious their position might be in an actual type of heated encounter, I think there could certainly be some doubts as to how reliable they would actually be in certain situations. Moreover, from the Chinese leadership side of the equation, I think as China's leadership becomes aware of just how aware outsiders are of the actual mechanics of China's maritime militia, when China's leadership realizes that they definitely can't fool the people who matter anymore in terms of policy and operations, and they also can't expect to fool large numbers of citizens in the court of public opinion, I think whatever they may say in public, they are going to have growing doubts about how effectively they can use and control this force in certain types of frontline incidents. So I think if we can just continue to shed sunlight on this issue, I believe that we can achieve a growing degree of deterrence against China's use of this shadowy third sea force in the types of situations that would be of greatest concern to us as well as our allies and our regional security partners.
Kind of, I'm always kind of hesitant to ask these questions because I think I know the answer. But I think it's important when we look at how we respond and how we hold ourselves accountable with our checks and balances. But especially when issues such as this rise to the top, you know, we've been talking about, I think it was February of 2010, up on a panel, kind of what sparked us to start talking about lawfare in China. Captain Stu Belt, I thought, gave a real nice discussion of it back in 2010, and keeping an eye on it. But when it starts to reach a certain level, you have to look up at the Hill. You know, who at the House of Representatives and who in the Senate can we look at, for lack of a better phrase, as a knowledgeable China hand when these issues, whether they're policy, whether they're treaty, whether it's funding certain things, building relationships with other companies, other countries, you can look at this senator or senators or representatives that have the knowledge and the background and the at least the intellectual curiosity on the subject to be reliable China hands on the legislative side of the House. Do we have some of those players that people should keep an ear out for when they're discussing China, that somebody they should perhaps listen to?
Well, that is an excellent question, and I am optimistic there are others who can discuss this issue on your show. I had better stay out of weighing different political leaders against each other, but what I can say is that whenever I have had a chance to sit down and talk with people in Washington, whether they're administration officials, members of Congress, congressional staffers, I found that when people pay direct attention to these issues, I think there's a chance to make a lot of progress. I think part of the problem is not enough people are making some of these issues enough of a priority to focus on a day-to-day basis, whether it's putting enough focus on U.S. Shipbuilding infrastructure, how do we keep developing and maintaining American sea power in a serious and sustainable way. And I know your program has brought on some top experts who really are focused on that, and you're serving as a valuable platform to keep the focus on that. One of the things that I've been emphasizing in my personal capacity is that the 2016 Pentagon China report missed a major opportunity by failing utterly to mention the maritime militia at all. And Congress has a valuable role to play in terms of laying out some of the things that need to be in that report. And unfortunately, we'd have to wait for the 2017 iteration, but I think for sure I'm very hopeful that the 2017 iteration will have one of those large, maybe multi-page sections that goes in depth on the maritime militia, because that's the sort of thing that gets the attention of key maritime, people with an ability to influence maritime Navy policy of the U.S., national security policy. There are a lot of people, from my understanding, in Washington who care generally about national security issues in the Asia-Pacific and have some ability to make a positive contribution to that, but they don't have all the time to become specialists on China's military development. So if something's not in that Pentagon China report, it might impact the awareness of key people. But the other thing is, I personally believe long before that Pentagon China report, the next iteration comes out under the next administration, I personally, in my personal capacity, I'm urging the current administration to get out in front of this pressing issue and make some authoritative statements. I think it's an idea whose time has more than come, and I'm optimistic that there could be some movement there. But anyone on Capitol Hill who is concerned about the lack of public mention of the maritime militia in the first two venues that I've described, I hope will take up the mantle of this issue and use their important platforms to raise it themselves. This is a subject on which we need many different voices bringing up the key issues, and you know, let's have a good debate about them. But let's have it out in the open so it's clear there's awareness. I would sum it up as the relevant branches of the U.S. government, in my personal view, and the relevant policy communities that support them and can also challenge them and energize them need to contribute in four different areas, four different follow-ons, if you will, on this issue. First of all, as I said, call out China's maritime militia in public, and those who have discussions with PRC interlocutors also need to raise this issue in conversations with them. Even if the Chinese interlocutors refuse to acknowledge the issue at all, by continually bringing it up, it's going to be a lot more on China's radar screen, and sooner or later, China's going to have to deal with the issue in more of a public communications type way. There is already at least one major China Daily article in China's state media acknowledging the Chinese maritime militia and important aspects of its development and its military relevance. So we can point to their very own official media statements. There's no way that this is deniable at this point. I think that the U.S. also needs to make a greater effort to share information with countries at risk in the region. From my personal conversations, at least, it seems like some important stakeholders in some of the regional maritime countries, they feel they have enough information for themselves to understand the maritime militia. They're confused as to why the U.S. itself has not said very much about this, and not in a sort of central government authoritative way. Number three, I think in official U.S. government communications, it's my personal recommendation that we make it clear that any elements that ignore repeated warnings by U.S. vessels to desist from disruptive activities will be treated as military controlled, and they'll be dealt with accordingly to ensure self-defense and unobstructed mission accomplishment. I think we need to be very clear about that and very serious about that. And I think we can, with such clear, well-informed communications, actually achieve some deterrence. And finally, should there be some sort of an improper use of China's maritime militia against U.S. vessels, I think we need to impose some sort of consequences. What shape that should take exactly is a legitimate matter of discussion, and I'm hopeful that your program could be one venue for that. But as I look back on all the things I've found out with my colleague Connor Kennedy by sifting through these many Chinese language open sources, one of the things that surprises me the most in retrospect is that the U.S. was treated improperly in this impeccable incident of March 2009. There was direct, demonstrable, VIN number traceable maritime militia involvement right at the front lines of that. And certainly in public, I can say, the U.S. government never mentioned publicly or called out China's maritime militia at that time. Well, I think that sent the wrong signal. It probably sent a signal to China that China could get away with this kind of thing without perhaps a full complement of U.S. policymakers and decision makers fully understanding this shadowy sea force. And I think we need to fully and clearly and publicly change that before the next such incident occurs.
Well, I've got probably a long question. We got a short period of time, but on the Naval Institute blog, I put up when I was putting the advertisement for the program up there, I put up a picture of Winfield Scott's Anaconda strategy. And my reason for doing so is that I see, as I step back from what's going on here, I see China applying its own Anaconda strategy to the South China Sea and perhaps to the other disputes it has in the region. Is there a similarity to what they're doing? And was I wrong to see that?
I think there are a number of historical parallels that can be a useful way to look at this, and I definitely think that one has merit as well. I think at the heart of this, China is trying to gradually, over the long term, further its disputed island feature and maritime claims while never raising things to the point of outright conflict. And so far, in many ways, this strategy has paid off for China. I've mentioned incidents, including over the last few years, some of which included the U.S. directly. That was quite negative. The good news is I think we now have some good options to finally turn the tide on this and to call it out. And that's a great source of optimism for me. And I look forward to discussing this further with you and others in the community so we can figure out how to move forward on this.
And Andrew, with that is a real fast hour. Really appreciate you taking an opportunity to flesh out, and hopefully it gives everybody a little more information on what China is doing with their maritime militia, but more importantly, it'll get people to thinking in other dimensions, in other ways that they're trying to create effects in the South China Sea. I want to give you an opportunity here. If people wanted to catch up on more that you have been working on, where could they go to find it, and what could we expect to hear from you next?
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that, and it's been a real pleasure to join you here in this conversation. And I want, as I said, I'd like to continue it. In terms of what I'm trying to bring to that conversation, you can always find everything at www.andrewerickson.com, AndrewErickson.com. In fact, if you go to the top post right there, not only does it have information on this program we've been enjoying today, but there's a running set of links and excerpts if you scroll down that entry covering all of my work on China's maritime militia, as well as some other leading contributions that I've found from my colleagues, for example, Toshi Yoshihara and James Kraska. So I'm always working on my website. Whatever I have is the latest maritime militia related post. I will keep posting below it this long, text searchable, scroll downable master compilation to give everyone one-stop shopping of stuff they might want to look into to get some more details and some other sources, as well as to find out some what are some actual Chinese sources. I put up the best Chinese government English language sources on the maritime militia, so people can go for that directly and see for themselves. But additionally, in this Center for International Maritime Security series with my colleague Connor Kennedy, within the next few days, we should have another piece up for everybody in this series on the leading maritime militias of Hainan Province, and this time we're going to go to Sansha City, this newly created artificial municipality on Woody Island, the largest island in the Paracels that China took from Vietnam in 1974, and this this very large and capable maritime militia is sort of the shape of things to come. It's built very quickly on the Tonman militia model, but it has some new cutting-edge capabilities. So anyone who's interested in that can get a lot of details, and you can go to the SimSec website, but I'll also, as always, be posting a link on my website at andrewerickson.com, so people can always be assured that it'll be available there.
Perfect, and thanks again for this afternoon, and I hope you have a great week.
You too. Gentlemen, thank you both very much. It's been a great pleasure, and I look forward to being in touch.
Perfect, really appreciate it, and thank you everybody for joining us for another edition of Midrats, and until we see you again, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Thank you.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Tipperary, but my heart's right there.